what does it mean to be a veteran in the 21st century?
Being a veteran, it's hard because in the military, we're all one unit. And then you're out on your own and you're like, okay, what do I do? Because you're used to a team.
More than 2 million veterans have returned home from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, the most since the Vietnam era. But they don't always fit in. Not at the workplace.
The adjustment period is tough. We have a different culture, we have different values, we have different ideas about morality.
Sometimes not even at the VFW hall.
Went to a district meeting and I didn't have my VFW hat on. I said, I don't want to wear that hat, you know? All you young punks.
In the next hour, we'll talk about what it means to be a veteran today. This is After the Uniform, a special report from the American Homefront Project. This is After the Uniform, a special report from the American Homefront Project. I'm Adam Hochberg.
It's our great privilege to be here with you today and to honor you and all the brave men and women who have served in the defense of freedom.
Just about every week somewhere in America, there are events like this one, a salute to the nation's veterans. This ceremony and band concert were at American Legion Post 6 in Chapel Hill, North Carolina. But you'll find people honoring troops at a lot of other places, not just at Legion halls, but at shopping malls, at parades down Main Street, and ceremonies before ball games. There are so many salutes and so many people thanking veterans for their service that even the former troops themselves can have mixed emotions about all the expressions of gratitude. Nick Cervantes served in the Air Force from 2008 to 2014.
You know, we have different technologies that are available to us now, so YouTube and social media has allowed people to get a glimpse of the battlefield. Everybody sees the war that we're in, so we are almost forced to talk about it. And it does weigh a little bit on me, but at the same time, you know, it's good that we get greeted with a lot of support.
Meanwhile, some older members of Post 6 say that support today is very different from what they felt when they came home from earlier wars.
There's a whole new respect for the military that Vietnam veterans never did get.
Edward Gill, the Post 6 Sergeant at Arms, fought in Vietnam in 1965 and 66.
We did not get a welcome home. We got spit on, attacked, rocks thrown at us. It's still a sore spot with me.
Gill says he's happy today's veterans don't have to deal with that perception that they're unappreciated. But he says there's a generation gap between those who fought in recent wars in Iraq and Afghanistan and their predecessors who served in Vietnam and Korea. Today's vets came of age in different eras, fought a different kind of warfare, and now are integrating back into civilian life in a country that's evolved since the 1960s and 70s. Over the past year at the American Homefront Project, we've been reporting on what it means to be a veteran today. We'll listen to some of those reports in the next hour, beginning at another American Legion post, where Jay Price found that some members are making an effort to bridge the generations.
At American Legion Post 87 in High Point, North Carolina, the bar is jumping, even though some of the patrons are almost 70 years old.
November of 68 to April of 69.
That's Frederick Iannone talking about when he served in Vietnam. He's the commander of Post 87. Many of the vets at the post are his age or older.
The sad part is some of the older vets, the World War II, the Korean vets, they're passing on. You know, not good, you know, the Vietnam veterans so far, we're holding on.
Iannone, who's 68, says attracting younger members is hard. More than 2,000 Legion and VFW posts have closed. Posts that, with their parades and scholarships and baseball leagues, had for decades been deeply woven into the fabric of their communities. Iannone believes young veterans will join when they're older and have more free time. But attracting some now is crucial.
We need the younger blood to carry on the fight. Because, now I tell them, the American Legion is the one that got you the right to go to a VA to get benefits.
Which brings up the other place, where the big veterans groups have been a major force in American society, Capitol Hill.
We're going to meet in here?
Sure.
You want to do
Raymond Kelly heads the VFW's lobbying and policy efforts. He's come to see Steve Robertson, who handles veterans issues for Senator Bernie Sanders.
And we found that, like 80% who qualify for health care and have some other form of insurance still use VA some of the time.
And proximity is another factor.
Yeah.
In years past, the Legion and VFW used their political muscle to win iconic benefits for veterans, like the GI Bill, and the Department of Veterans Affairs itself, which runs the nation's largest health care system. The groups are still political giants that can summon the wrath or the blessing of millions of voters.
We read a lot of legislation, we read a lot of reports that come out, and as we do that, we engage members of Congress. And we have a grassroots advocacy program that asks our members to engage with members back home. So even if we aren't as large, we will still have a big impact on policy moving forward.
But in order to keep that muscle, they need younger vets who've been slow to join the groups that their fathers and grandfathers used to frequent. Legion and VFW leaders have been encouraging posts to make themselves more family-friendly, to move away from the stereotype of old guys swapping war stories in smoky bars. This is a kid's pumpkin carving party at VFW Post 8469 in Fairfax, Virginia, where 29-year-old Walter Sweeney is commander.
The idea behind this event is to bring out some of the veterans with families and potentially some community members who are eligible to be members of the post but haven't heard of us.
Northern Virginia has lots of younger veterans, and Post 8469 wants to make them feel at home. It has a lively website and Facebook page, and at least once a quarter it tries something new, like the pumpkin carving.
I'm going to risk getting in trouble with higher-up VFW and say that we should have been where we are today 10 years ago in the way that we reach out to younger veterans, in the way that we organize our online media. You know, we can't just sit here and wait for people to walk in. We have to go out and get them.
But some posts won't even try to connect with young veterans, and they don't have to. They're independent, like franchises. And even for those that do try, if they aren't in places with lots of young veterans, then even fancy websites and pumpkin carvings might not be enough.
Does anybody want a cookie for the road?
Oh, we'll take it.
I'm Jay Price, reporting.
I'm Patricia Murphy in Seattle. As traditional veterans organizations like the American Legion and VFW lose members, younger vets are socializing in new ways. They're gravitating towards smaller, more specialized groups that offer a social outlet and an opportunity to serve. Take, for instance, Josh Wheeldon, who left the Army in 2009 and is now a member of more than a half dozen different veterans groups.
Team Rubicon, the Mission Continues AmeriCorps Vet Corps program.
From his office at the South Seattle Food Bank where he works, Wheeldon ticks off a list of veterans groups he volunteers with.
IAVA, Growing Vets, 22 Kill, Red, White, and Blue, the Seattle Stand Down. I'm a member of like all of it but Red, White, and Blue because I don't like to run.
Wheeldon is also a lifetime member of the Veterans of Foreign Wars. He has a reverence for his dad's generation of soldiers and for the organization. His father was a post commander, but he doesn't always feel like he fits in.
Went to a district meeting and I didn't have my VFW hat on. It's the cutest hat in the world. I said, I don't want to wear that hat, you know? Oh, you young punks. But that's the culture, right? You got to fit in.
Wheeldon is 32 years old. He's typical of the generation of veterans who often feel disconnected from legacy groups like the VFW and American Legion. Those groups have lost more than a million members in the past 20 years. For Wheeldon, it was the hat. For other younger vets, it's the atmosphere at the local Legion and VFW posts. John Knox is a 32-year-old former Marine from Orfordville, Wisconsin.
The American Legion, it was active in the town I grew up in. And it was just a drinking place. Knowing that alcohol abuse and alcoholism is definitely prevalent, there's definitely an aversion that way.
But Knox, who now lives in Seattle, still wanted to be around other veterans who knew what it was like to serve in the military. First, he joined Iraq Veterans Against the War. Then he discovered a group called Growing Veterans. The group is made up of more than 100 veterans who share farmland around Puget Sound and grow crops to sell at farmers markets.
So I'm going to put $22 on your card.
Knox says learning to farm helped him transition back to civilian life. The work is physical, and he says when contrasted with the experience of war, can be profoundly healing. For a lot of vets, he says, as the plants grow, walls come down.
Like, we get Vietnam veterans coming up saying, I wish something like this was available when I was getting out of the service. and it's what keeps me coming back, really.
Growing Veterans is one of hundreds of smaller, more specialized veterans groups that weren't available to the Vietnam generation or to veterans before them. So instead of deciding only among the VFW, American Legion, and a few other legacy groups, today's returning service members often are looking for a more personalized experience. Seth Messinger is an anthropologist at the Uniformed Services University of the Health Sciences in Bethesda, Maryland.
These individuals are shopping through groups depending on where they are in their post-service life.
There are service organizations, outdoor adventure clubs, a fly fishing group, one that teaches glass blowing, all just for veterans. And like a lot of institutions nowadays, the older groups are finding those brick-and-mortar local posts don't speak to younger veterans the way a Facebook page and a crowded Google calendar do.
The brick-and-mortar VFW halls may, at least initially, appear to demand a greater commitment than being able to move from site to site in the online environment.
Josh Wielden, the Army vet in South Seattle, stays electronically connected with all the groups he's involved in. But his local VFW post hasn't updated its Facebook page since 2011.
It's an older generation, and Facebook isn't their thing, you know. But if you want to learn how to split wood or go sight in a rifle or cook a mean chili, you know, these are the guys that you talk to.
Wielden says the VFW is a part of American culture that he would hate to lose, and he feels a kinship to his fellow service members of an earlier generation. But he says that's not enough to make the groups relevant to a lot of younger veterans.
Reporter Patricia Murphy from American Homefront Station KUOW in Seattle. Next, we'll talk about the stigmas that troops sometimes encounter when they return home and how that affects their transition into civilian life. And throughout the hour, we'll be hearing from former service members about what it means to be a veteran today.
My name is Solimar Santos. I was in the United States Army 2007 till 2015, June. I guess being a vet, you know, when people say thank you for your service, and I'm like, oh, well, you know, I did choose that as a career. You know, we all get paid to do these things, but never do they tell you the things that you're going to experience, you know, like, hey, this equipment will protect you from IEDs, you know, and then your friends die, or hey, you know, you see like little boys getting like abused, or women, and you can't do anything about it. So it's a kind of a culture shock, and yet we're expected to perform at the same level as everybody else. So being a veteran, I guess, just means dealing with more stuff than everybody else does.
You're listening to After the Uniform from the American Homefront Project. This is After the Uniform, a special report from the American Homefront Project.
My name's Adriana Moore. I served on the USS Boxer in San Diego from 2003 to 2007. I think there's definitely stigmas for veterans, especially like when we're trying to like re-enter the communities for employment or for school. And some of it is self-fulfilling. You know, if we go to a job or we go to some kind of environment where we're meant to like acclimate, the adjustment period is tough. We have a different culture, we have different values, we have different ideas about morality. And so if you don't focus on our strengths and you don't recognize those kinds of differences that we have, those stigmas and the stereotypes about like PTSD or violence or whatever, they end up becoming self-fulfilling prophecies, because if you're constantly going to a place where you're feeling misunderstood and undervalued and underappreciated, you're gonna act out. You're gonna just fill the role that everybody was kind of labeling you as.
So what comes into your mind when you picture a military veteran? Some of us might conjure up the image of a tough-looking Marine in battle fatigues, or a dapper soldier in her dress uniform. But the image that pops into other people's minds often isn't so positive. Many veterans say they frequently confront the stigma that people coming out of the service are fragile or damaged, scarred from warfare, or consumed by post-traumatic stress. It's a characterization that can hold back new veterans as they try to make the already difficult transition from military to civilian life. For the next few minutes, we'll talk about that transition and why, for many vets, leaving the battlefield can be almost as difficult as fighting on it. We begin with a near-universal challenge that faces transitioning troops, the effort to find a civilian job. Here's Patricia Murphy.
In the Army, you don't get a job. You get an MOS, a military occupational specialty.
I was a 35 Mike human intelligence collector.
That means something to people in the Army. It means that Sergeant Madeline Warrington, while she was deployed to Iraq and Afghanistan, gathered information on possible enemy threats. But once Warrington left the military and started looking for a civilian job, that MOS meant nothing to most employers. Warrington says she submitted resumes for more than 100 civilian jobs.
I found when I was looking for a job that the ones that required essentially no skills were willing to contact me back. But the ones that were more office job related, they'd be like, hey, yeah, we're not interested. We don't think that you have the necessary qualifications. You know, and for the jobs that I was going for, I knew I had the skill sets because of the various jobs I've done while in the military. But it's really hard to quantify that.
In Warrington's world, it's hard not to feel defeated. Like many members of the armed forces, Warrington was doing dangerous work overseas. She was responsible for troops and the safety of millions of dollars of equipment and weapons. Monica McNeil tries to help vets like Warrington. She's the Seattle program director at 4Block, a national nonprofit that works with former service members looking for employment. McNeil says when service members talk about their military job experience, they can baffle civilian hiring managers.
Way too much information, and in some cases using maybe too many military terms that the average civilian who's hiring will not understand. So you have to kind of interpret that on the resume so there's a correlation of what their MOS is and what the civilian task is.
McNeil says the cultural shift of moving from active duty to civilian life can be disorienting for new veterans seeking work. Life in the armed forces is extremely regimented. Everyone has a job. The hierarchy is clear. You can tell a lot about someone by looking at the patches and medals on their uniform. It's not as clear-cut in the civilian workforce, where office culture can range from three-piece suits to flip-flops.
In a civilian world, you might be talking to a multimillionaire owner of the company, and you may never know that. So it's really important to learn to network and find out how to get to know people and to talk about yourself.
That's what a group of young veterans was trying to do here at an airport hotel near Seattle. They're here to do interviews with potential employers. 21 veterans, one day, 114 interviews total. These vets are working with Georgia-based military recruiting company Bradley Morris. Recruiter Ty Terrazone says the group spent the previous day in a kind of interviewing boot camp, practicing everything from solid handshakes to interviewing via Skype. That gives veterans an opportunity to work on framing their military service for potential non-military employers.
What we do is break them into small groups, about six or seven in a group, have them go around answering questions, tell me about yourself, give me a time that you failed as a leader, tell me about some times that your leadership's worked.
Though many of the veterans here made contacts and picked up some interviewing skills, Terrazone says nobody actually walked away from the event with a job offer in hand. And Madeline Warrington knows how hard it can be for vets in the job market to seal the deal. She ended up taking a job she felt she was overqualified to do, selling new cars at a Nissan dealership. Like a lot of military service members, Warrington's time at war opened her eyes to a greater sense of mission.
If you twist it just right, you have the purpose of helping people get into the vehicle that they need, you know? But it's not on the same level as helping your country.
As it turned out, Warrington wasn't a car saleswoman for long. Instead, she's a customer service agent for AT&T. Still not as lofty as serving your country, but Warrington says she finds some comfort in working for a large corporation. The structure and performance expectations are clear and reminds her of what she's used to in the military.
We now move from veterans trying to find jobs to veterans trying to find places to live. Several government programs are designed to help new veterans transition from their barracks or military housing into civilian homes. But those programs sometimes fall short. One such initiative gives veterans vouchers they can use to pay their rent. But as John Ismay reports, it's often a struggle finding landlords willing to accept the vouchers. and willing to put aside their stereotypes about veterans.
In Southern California, one of the country's most expensive housing markets, there are more than 4,000 homeless vets. In Long Beach, social worker Veronica Schenkelberg is meeting up with one of them.
Hi, Veronica.
Hi, Mr. Carrillo. How are you?
I'm hanging in there.
Adrian Carrillo, a former paratrooper who is based at Fort Bragg, North Carolina, has been looking for an apartment in California since April. But he hasn't been able to find one, even though he has a VASH voucher. VASH stands for Veterans Affairs Supportive Housing. It takes the usual Section 8 federal housing voucher and layers other help on top, like medical care and job assistance. This morning, Carrillo has a list of four apartments he's going to visit. His fiancée, Lori Garland, and their five-year-old daughter are along for the ride.
If it was just me and Lori, it's one thing, we can hang in there, but it's very, very painful when your daughter wakes up crying and she says, "This is not our house, Daddy. I want to go back to North Carolina. I want to go back to the old house." Man, it just tears you up.
By his account, Carrillo's called 100 places and visited more than 50. But with rental prices high and vacancy rates low, Carrillo can't find an apartment that will take his voucher. This one, a complex in Anaheim with a swimming pool and decorative fountain, wouldn't let him in.
Yes, hello. We're interested in an apartment. Can we please come in?
You only go by appointments?
Yes.
Schenkelberg leaves a message, but doesn't have much hope.
They never call me back. Never. So we are just as frustrated as he is.
According to government figures, more than 3,000 vets in Southern California have found housing using VASH, but another 700 are in Carrillo's shoes. Schenkelberg says one of the big reasons is money. VASH vouchers aren't keeping up with market rents. In pricey housing markets with low vacancy rates, landlords can be picky.
If they're asking for $1,150 and housing is only paying $1,100 because of the market value, then housing cannot pay more. The landlords usually will not reduce the rent because they have enough.
Even for $50?
Even for $25.
And money's not the only barrier that homeless veterans sometimes face. Charles Lazar owns 5 rental buildings in Los Angeles. He says landlords want to be patriotic and help those who served, but they also have to be careful.
What happens if somebody does have mental issues and they're not being addressed? When you have somebody screaming in the middle of the night and you've got people waking up and kids that are small and they're scared, then you have to deal with it. What are you going to do?
It's not unique to veterans, so you're...
Mental issues, sure. I'm just saying that there may be some problems that affect other tenants and as the owner, you have to be aware of that.
That stigma can make it even harder for vets than for other people with Section 8 vouchers. Ed Cabrera is a spokesman for the Department of Housing and Urban Development, the federal agency that runs Section 8.
There are a lot of stereotypes out there that affect veterans who have returned from combat or from current theaters. So a lot of education needs to happen.
Oh, thank you very much.
At the end of the day, Carrillo isn't any closer to an apartment. Schenkelberg, the case manager, tells him not to give up.
Hang in there. Hang in there. Things do get better, really. Yeah. They really do.
I don't know what to do. I mean, my only thing is just to go to Plan B.
After a lot of soul searching, Carrillo decided to give up on LA. He said he's going to give up his voucher and go live with friends in Texas.
Of all the unflattering narratives about veterans, here's one of the most corrosive. The number 22, as in the often reported statistic that 22 veterans a day commit suicide. That number originated in a 2013 study from the Department of Veterans Affairs. But the statistic frequently is taken out of context, and the reality behind that number isn't simple, nor is the question of how younger veterans may be affected by people misinterpreting the study. Last fall, American Homefront reporter Jay Price looked into the statistic and its effects.
22, not something vague or rounded off, not 30, not 20, 22. A number so specific it inspires instant credibility. and action.
A retired Marine vet has walked more than 1,000 miles.
There were lots of news stories last summer about Toby Flaggett, who walked from Oregon to New Jersey wearing a t-shirt that said, 22 is 22 too many.
The police officer and Marine Corps veteran stopped in Clinton, Iowa Wednesday, hoping to raise awareness about the problem of veteran suicide.
People don't want to talk about it, but it's a real problem.
Every day, 22 veterans commit suicide.
And almost weekly, there are other walks, swims, and runs dedicated to that number. Street corner rallies on the 22nd of each month, and 22-kilometer marches in California and Texas led by shirtless Marines in short shorts carrying packs that weigh 22 kilograms. And the statistic has inspired more than just physical challenges.
Now today, we lose 22 veterans a day to suicide.
That's President Obama at a national mental health conference in 2013.
Mr. President, every day, approximately 22 American veterans commit suicide.
And that's Senator John McCain endorsing the Clay Hunt Suicide Prevention for American Veterans Act. It was named after a veteran of the Afghanistan and Iraq wars who killed himself. But as it turns out, 22 a day has little to do with veterans of those wars. Iraq combat veteran Keith Jennings is a clinical psychologist who studies suicide prevention and acts as chief science advisor for a Durham, North Carolina-based group called StopSoldierSuicide.org.
That number, we talk about it out of context, it's questionable.
And there's a lot of context. Jennings says the 22 research was a Herculean effort by good scientists, but that it's often misused. The study that came up with the figure clearly mentioned some big caveats. First, it's hard to know from death certificates whether somebody is actually a veteran. And second, more than two-thirds of the people in the study who killed themselves were at least 50 years old. Department of Defense epidemiologist and statistician Derek Smolensky says suicide studies are usually full of caveats like that, in part because suicide is relatively rare.
The numbers that happen with suicide are much less than you would get with something, say, you know, a cold or a flu. With the military and the veteran populations, it takes so long to put together good data on suicide research because we need enough time to lapse to allow enough cases to accrue for us to start making meaningful sense of the data.
And of course, you can't ask questions of the people you most need to study, the victims. Smolensky, who works at Joint Base Lewis-McChord in Washington State, was among the authors of two major suicide studies published this year. One found that veterans who served during the Afghanistan and Iraq wars commit suicide at a rate of about one a day. The other concluded that Americans deployed to those wars were actually less likely to kill themselves than those who served during the same period but didn't go to war. Smolensky cites caveats too, and says his study shouldn't be compared directly with the 22 study. But like many suicide researchers, he says he's become used to seeing his work misinterpreted.
I'm at the point where I shrug it off. The popular media will latch on to whatever number they want to and go forth from there.
But misinterpreting data can have serious consequences. Dr. Bruce Capehart is a psychiatrist who heads the mental health program for Afghanistan and Iraq veterans at the Durham VA Medical Center. Capehart says reliable data is literally a matter of life and death.
That helps us focus what should our efforts be in terms of outreach, education, prevention, and treatment, because we have very good treatments for these mental health conditions, but we have to know who the people are who need those treatments before we can help them become engaged in care.
And there's a more subtle issue about the figure of 22 suicides a day. While it's been a valuable tool for drawing more attention to veterans' issues, Jennings worries it contributes to a corrosive stereotype of Iraq and Afghanistan veterans.
There's a narrative that goes something like, American enlists, American goes to war, American comes back and is diagnosed with a mental health condition or is broken, and because they have PTSD, they ultimately kill themselves. That's a false narrative.
And it's not the first. Jennings is the son of a Vietnam vet and grew up surrounded by successful, well-adjusted veterans of that war. Even so, he says, when he thinks about Vietnam vets, his mind conjures up the cartoonish stereotype of the Vietnam veteran on a street corner, begging from a wheelchair with a POW MIA flag. This kind of narrative is powerful stuff. Today, some even worry that all the talk of 22 deaths a day, without the caveats, may be leading more young veterans to kill themselves.
That kind of is the thing that scares me a little bit about being very overt and talking about it. Does it legitimize it as a course of action?
Ilario Pantano is an Iraq combat veteran who also served as North Carolina's Assistant Secretary of Veterans Affairs. He says the stereotype can also make life harder, even for vets who aren't struggling with mental health problems.
Potentially, it causes an employer to be reluctant to hire a veteran, or somebody be uncomfortable to be in a relationship with a veteran, and then that can lead to a negative spiral downstream just because there's some perception that there's some fragility or danger, you know, associated with that person.
Pantano doesn't want to minimize the issue of veteran suicides. Even though 22 a day isn't close to the real number of Iraq and Afghanistan vets who kill themselves, part of the complex reality is that some still do. Both Jennings and Pantano each say men who served under them in Iraq killed themselves after coming home. Pantano keeps the photo of one in his office.
What I will tell you is that one is too many. One a day is too many. 22 a day is a number that that hurts the mind.
So it is true that even young veterans are more likely to kill themselves than people who haven't served in the military, and that small but significant numbers of them suffer problems such as PTSD and traumatic brain injury. But Jennings says people should remember the complex truth about suicide when they meet a young combat veteran or when they hear that 22 statistic.
What gets lost in the conversation is that the majority, actually you can say the vast majority of folks, do okay. The vast majority of our veterans do okay.
American Homefront reporter Jay Price of North Carolina Public Radio WUNC with a story we originally broadcast in October 2015. Next, we'll hear about people and organizations that are helping new veterans make the jump into civilian life, including a housing program that's had some success finding vets places to live, and a law enforcement initiative designed to prevent misunderstandings between vets and local police.
I'm Gary Cashman. I served from 94 to 2005, and then moved back to the States 3 years ago. I've been overseas for, 30 years almost. Come back and learned a lot that there's a lot of people I just don't understand, but I think nowadays some of the veterans need to learn that we're the ones that are reintegrating back into the 99%. We're the 1%, and a lot of the younger guys think that we're the 1%, they need to understand us. And I've actually learned a lot in the last few years that we have to learn to reintegrate ourselves. And so I think for the civilians, it should be to be accepting of us and understand us and don't really poke and prod, just accept and say, hey, welcome back. Here's a job, here's some whatever else, and then we'll all get along and be back to normal again. But the more we bring it up, it took me 10 years to pull down all my Iraq pictures, Afghanistan pictures. That helped me transition on, because if I left it up on the wall every day, I was reliving it every day. Taking that wall down sometimes, leave a couple coins out, get past it, and then just reintegrate and say, hey, I'm just like everybody else now. I want to go and go to the beach or go to the lake or do whatever. So that kind of helps you reintegrate. So for civilians, just accept us back as normal. I think that's probably the better way to do it.
You're listening to After the Uniform from the American Homefront Project. This is After the Uniform, a special report from the American Homefront Project.
My name is Crystal Dandridge Jackson, and I served in the U.S. Navy. In Canada, I lived in the Middle East. So being a veteran, it's hard because in the military, they train all of us. Like, we're all one unit. Even from the beginning of boot camp, you have 72 people from all walks of life and different cultures, and you put them together in one area, and they are all the same. They all transition, they dress alike, wear the same underwear even, use the same soap to bathe, so you have that connection, you're one. And then you're out on your own, and you're like, okay, what do I do? Because you're used to a team. You don't have that camaraderie or that support that you once had.
There are organizations and government agencies that try to support veterans who've recently returned home. And here's one that might surprise you. Police departments around the country are making special efforts to train their officers on how to deal with former service members. The goal is to break through stereotypes and help veterans in need resolve situations that otherwise could turn violent. Patricia Murphy went to Auburn, Washington to see how it works.
Officer Andy Gould is out on patrol for the Auburn Police Department. A computer screen in his patrol car rhythmically ticks off details of emergencies from dispatch. He's just wrapped up a burglary call.
2 out of 50, you can clear that follow-up on 7th as a Tom, and I'll take the suspicious subject on 37th.
As Gould drives, text from the dispatchers scrolls up the screen. It tells him where to go for his next call, what the problem is, and whether the people involved have ever been in the military.
That said no military history. Is that standard in there?
Real-time on video and audio.
Interesting.
Able to hear the 13-year-old stating he's going to kill her and her boyfriend while they're sleeping.
Gould says dispatchers started asking about military experience a few years ago.
Because if we have a guy that we're looking for, and he's the suspect in a crime, and they tell us he has, and they ask that question, the purpose for that is because he has elevated training that could be a danger to us. He knows how to shoot, move, and communicate.
Gould, a combat veteran himself, says his military experience sometimes helps him establish rapport with other veterans, but not always.
Especially when, you know, when we're responding to someone in a mental crisis and they're not the one that called. Sometimes they're not very happy when we get there.
Gould remembers one call about an armed man threatening suicide. He was a Marine veteran and had barricaded himself in his apartment with a shotgun. Dispatchers learned that the man was part of a Marine unit called First FAST.
FAST is Fleet Anti-Terrorism Security Teams.
Gould knew from his time in the Marines that the man was highly trained.
You have to take that into consideration when you're setting up and trying to deal with that guy, because if he really wanted to wreak some havoc, he certainly could. And had I not been there to tell my fellow officers that, no, this guy's highly trained, you know, let's, you know, be very, very careful, it would have went right over their heads.
So the next hour is going to be spent on both education, understanding, and some resources on veterans, and Josh's going to take you through...
This class is intended to make sure a person's military background doesn't go over a police officer's head. At the Washington State Criminal Justice Training Center in Burien, about 24 officers from Seattle and Auburn participate in a 40-hour crisis intervention training program. Former Marine Josh Penner told the class that veterans are often stereotyped.
There's a lot of incorrect ways veterans or law enforcement officers are identified by the general public. Right, we got gender, shape, color, religion, all the way down to behavior. Veteran lost his home, nearly committed suicide.
He says, while of course not every veteran has mental health problems, people who've served in the military can be culturally different. They're used to using acronyms. When they use salty language, he says, it means they like you. And in some cases, they've been trained to react differently under pressure. Bob Graham has managed the program since it was established in 2008.
Identification and de-escalation are the main topic areas that we try to focus on. If they can identify that they're a veteran, that opens a different gamut of de-escalation tools that you can use. And if you have officers that have a veteran background, they're going to be more effective.
A good portion of the class focuses on how to connect people in crisis to veteran or civilian resources. Graham says officers should look beyond the immediate situation.
You might be able to clear this call in 15 minutes, but if you take 45 minutes to do it and do a good job and hook them up with resources, you're not going to be back tomorrow, next week, three times this month.
Copy, help.
Back in Auburn, that's what Officer Gould and his colleagues tried to do when they encountered that suicidal ex-Marine. They talked with him and persuaded him to put down his shotgun and leave his apartment.
And he was at that point very cooperative. You know, he was having an emotional breakdown. He was in a mental crisis. And so we got an ambulance and we were going to have an involuntary commitment.
In Auburn, where 8% of the population has served in the military, crisis response training is mandatory for all officers. Overall, more than half the state's law enforcement agencies have officers who are trained in how to defuse people in a mental health crisis.
Shortly after Barack Obama became president in 2009, he announced an ambitious goal to end homelessness among veterans by the end of 2015. Now that the deadline has passed, the results are mixed. Earlier, we heard about homeless veterans in Los Angeles, one of the places that hasn't come close to meeting the goal. But other cities say they have hit their target of helping virtually all their homeless vets get off the street, including Philadelphia, Houston, and Winston-Salem, North Carolina. That's where American Homefront reporter Jay Price visited in December. He found that a combination of government and private sector investment is putting roofs over veterans' heads.
Wow.
Home, 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 says Army veteran James Wallace. He's walking in the front door of his new apartment as his wife, Jamie Jones, comes in the back lugging a garbage bag full of clothes. Last night, they slept in a homeless shelter. Tonight, though, they'll be sleeping in their own bed.
And you guys are moving in when?
Today.
1 minute
ago. I've been crying, so I'm just excited.
At the end of 2015, Winston-Salem, North Carolina, joined a handful of places around the country that declared victory in the battle to end homelessness among veterans. They met the standards set by the U.S. Interagency Council on Homelessness. That doesn't mean there aren't any more homeless vets here or that there won't be more, but it does mean the community has built a system designed to ensure that homeless vets are quickly identified and offered housing. Andrea Kurtz of the Forsyth County United Way is director of the local Commission on Ending Homelessness.
A lot of it is about building partnerships, building collaborations, and working together. And I think, particularly in social services, we talk a lot about people becoming self-reliant. But the truth of the matter is, the people in the world who are most successful, they aren't self-reliant. They are connected into a community, and they have a community of support behind them.
Creating that system meant pulling together a loose network of sometimes independent-minded charities, donors, government agencies, and employers. Winston-Salem's approach is part of a national shift to a policy called Housing First. It emphasizes getting homeless people into permanent housing quickly, rather than requiring them first to get treatment for issues that might have contributed to their homelessness, like substance abuse or mental illness. Terry Alabaugh is with the North Carolina Department of Military and Veterans Affairs.
There has been a shift from instead of let's build more shelters for veterans, let's focus on getting veterans into permanent housing. So just being clear about your goals has provided a lot for our communities.
Alabaugh says another big piece of the solution has been hundreds of millions of dollars in new federal funding to house homeless veterans. That's helped Winston-Salem and several other places, including Fayetteville and the entire state of Virginia, to declare an end to veteran homelessness. And the successful places are becoming models not just for beating homelessness among veterans, but for doing it with a collaborative approach, even in cases where vets need transitional housing.
I got in trouble from alcohol, and next thing I know, I couldn't hold a job. I was chronically homeless. I'd stay on people's couches, and that wouldn't last. They'd get tired of it.
You've probably heard stories before, like Robert Worley's. The Navy veteran caused so much trouble when he was drunk that he was fired from a carnival and even booted out of a space sleeping in a barn. But you probably haven't heard one of those stories turn into this.
I'm going to school. I'm going to Winston-Salem State to get my bachelor's degree in social work. And I qualified for the Pell Grant and the student loans, and it's been working out pretty good.
After getting out of jail, where he'd been locked up on an old drunk driving charge, Worley ended up in a homeless shelter. There, he met the program director for a new transitional housing facility called Veterans Helping Veterans Heal. He steered Worley into an outpatient treatment program for substance abusers.
And that's probably what saved my life.
In 2013, Worley was able to move into VHVH, as it's called. The 24-bed facility is the product of collaboration. It was built with grants from the VA and BB&T Bank, and it's run with VA funding and local donations. VHVH counseled Worley on the skills he needs for living inside society rather than outside.
And I couldn't have never done it without Veterans Helping Veterans Heal, because I had security, I had a place to stay.
Now he's got a different place to stay, his own apartment, and big plans to become a VA social worker so he can help other veterans fit into society too.
You're listening to After the Uniform from the American Homefront Project.
My name is Doug Pfeffer.
I was in the Navy for 4 years as a search and rescue swimmer, and then I was in the Army for the next 20 years as a forward observer. And I always felt like being a veteran meant, you know, service. It's important to us, and I think that it's part of us, and it's part of the package deal. When whether we're in uniform or whether we've left the military, it's always going to be there with us. If you run into a veteran on the street, that person is always going to be a veteran, and they may not be able to run as fast as they did when they were in their 20s or be as brave as they were when they were in their 20s, but they're still going to carry it in their heart. And I think that it's important for civilians to understand that whoever we are, wherever we are, we're always going to be carrying our veteranness with us.
Finally, this hour, military veterans have a lot of institutions that are dedicated to serving them and only them. They have their own hospitals, their own cemeteries, and in some states, even their own prisons. Increasingly, America's universities also are tailoring special programs just for veterans. Since 9/11, hundreds of thousands of military veterans have been able to go back to school, largely on the federal government's dime. So universities all over the country are recruiting them and trying to make it easier for them to succeed as students. At the University of Southern California, John Ismay found something unique, a college degree called an MBV, a Master's of Business, just for veterans.
Blake Piquel is a senior manager at a Silicon Beach startup called Cargomatic. He works in a refurbished warehouse with high ceilings, exposed wooden beams, and a Tesla parked outside. On the day we visited, a Weimaraner Pitbull mix named London lounged by the reception desk. And Piquel talked with the company's lead engineer about updating their smartphone app.
You know, I think we need, the other step is to make sure these guys get on V2.
Excellent. Yeah, the sooner the better.
Cargomatic was founded 3 years ago as a high-tech way to link shippers with truckers.
We like to say we're the Uber for trucking.
But just a few years ago, Piquel was moving a very different kind of cargo. That's when he was Captain Piquel, United States Air Force, planning and executing deliveries to outer space.
My last duty station was Vandenberg. I did about 17 satellite launches, satellite or missile launches.
Piquel says the operations and logistics skills he learned in the service were great. But once he left the Air Force, he found he needed business training to get ahead. So he enrolled in USC's MBV program, the Master of Business for Veterans.
Without going to something like MBV, where I got practical understanding of both the finance world, the marketing world, I would not understand. I'd be much more pigeonholed into this traditional project management, which is a core function in the military, but I wanted to get away from that. I wanted to do something a little more creative.
USC started the MBV program in 2012. Instead of an MBA, which is typically a two-year residential program, the MBV is an accelerated one-year degree. Through programs such as the GI Bill, the federal government pays a big chunk of most students' tuition, which is nearly $50,000. James Bogle runs the program.
We are looking for proven leaders in the military who are transitioning out, but who have those fundamental professional skills down already.
Skills like logistics and management, and working as part of a team. But Bogle says what veterans need are business fundamentals, like accounting, finance, and statistics. And often, a change in perspective when they move from the rigid hierarchy of the armed forces to today's more dressed-down workplace.
Among the most important factors of your success in the civilian world are whether or not the people you work with like you. And that's simply not a factor in the military.
Bogle himself is a retired Army officer. His 23 years on active duty took him from the sands of Iraq and Kuwait to diplomatic posts in Paris. But it did not prepare him for what he and his students encountered in their civilian jobs.
We can be sitting around the table on a project group in the civilian world where there's nobody in charge. Everybody is of equal status, and you have to now try to figure out how to get the job done when there's nobody directing.
About 140 vets have graduated from the USC program so far. About half served as officers and half were enlisted. More than 70% are combat veterans, just like recent grad Barbara Jones. Jones says the MBV program did more than just give her business skills. It also helped her make the transition to civilian life after living through war.
I know that I lacked, you know, empathy. It's kind of hard to get excited about, you know, my friend and her dog getting hurt when you see much worse. So I just couldn't even relate to that.
She says having a peer group of all veterans in the classroom helped. They'd been where she'd been, and they just understood.
Instead of being like the bad guy, when I'm in a group of veterans, I can work through that process And as a result, I'm coming in, I know I was one way. And then at the end of the course, my son, he told me, it's like really the greatest compliment. He said, Mom, you look really happy now.
While many colleges have been making it easier for vets to attend as undergrads, USC is among a growing number of major universities tailoring master's degrees for them. The University of Virginia offers one in systems engineering, while the University of North Carolina has a curriculum for vets who want to be physician's assistants. The VA says the number of veterans on college campuses has doubled to more than 1 million since Congress passed the new GI Bill in 2008.
That's John Ismay reporting from KPCC Southern California Public Radio, one of the three public media newsrooms that collaborate on the American Homefront Project. The others are at KUOW Seattle and North Carolina Public Radio, WUNC. You've been listening to After the Uniform, an American Homefront Project special. We had reporting help for today's program from Bree Ripley in Seattle. I'm Adam Hochberg. Support for the American Homefront Project comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting as part of CPB's ongoing effort to expand coverage of local, regional, and national issues. You can hear all of our stories about the lives of America's service members and veterans online at AmericanHomefrontProject.org.